Hello, welcome to Time to Say Goodbye. It is the 17th of April. Today we have a special guest on our show, a special episode. He is Dr. Feroz Sidhwa. He is a trauma surgeon who has worked in war zones, disaster zones across the world throughout his career. And he just returned from a two-week stay at European Hospital in Gaza. He was kind enough to come and talk to us about it. So without further ado, here's our conversation with Dr. Sidhwa. We're really happy to welcome Dr. Feroz Sidhwa. He is a trauma and critical care surgeon in rural California, grew up in Flint, Michigan, and has done humanitarian work in southern Zimbabwe, Haiti, Ukraine, and the West Bank. The reason why we're having him on the show is because he recently spent 2 weeks in the Gaza Strip working with the World Health Organization at Gaza European Hospital in Khan Yunis. And he's been developing a working knowledge of the Israel-Palestine conflict since college and has edited books on the topic for the University of California Press and OR Books in London. Dr. Sidhwa, welcome to the show. I want to start off just by giving a little bit of an introduction. You know, you wrote a piece, you and your colleague, Dr. Mark Perlmutter, wrote a piece about what your experience was like for 2 weeks in Gaza. And I think that this is a good way to introduce who you are to the audience, which is, and this is, I'm reading from the piece here, we will link to it in the show notes. As humanitarian trauma surgeons, we have both seen incredible suffering. Collectively, we were present at Ground Zero and 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, the Boston Marathon bombing, and the 2010 earthquake in Haiti on the first day of these disasters. We have worked in the deprivation of southern Zimbabwe and the horrors of the war in Ukraine. Together, we have worked on more than 40 surgical missions in developing countries on three continents in our combined 57 years of volunteering. This long experience taught us that there is no greater pain as a humanitarian surgeon than being unable to provide needed care to a patient. In the piece, you go on to say that Gaza in some ways was different from these other disasters, right? Can you tell us how?
Yeah, definitely in a few ways. So we were at Gaza European Hospital. It's a small subspecialty hospital. It's got about 220 beds. Gaza's health system was fairly robust before this war, whatever you want to call it. It had about 36 hospitals. Right now, you know better than I do, probably about 90 plus percent of the population is displaced. The populated core of the Gaza Strip was Gaza City and basically the northern, everything north of Wadi Gaza, north of the Wadi in Gaza. Virtually the entire population is displaced south. There's 300,000 or 400,000 people left. Almost the full 2 million others are concentrated now in Rafah and in the northernmost place that is populated is Gaza European Hospital and the camp right outside it. So this has led to some unusual situation. Like when I was in, you said, how is it different from other places? Like when I was in Ukraine, there's also a ton of displaced people in Ukraine. The Donbas is basically, as far as I can tell, I've never been there because I was doing educational work when I was there. But the Donbas in Ukraine, where the eastern part of the country where the war is going on, has been largely depopulated of civilians. And the war is extremely brutal there, but it's happening between soldiers for the most part. And the displaced people from the Donbas can at least go to a place that is, you know, yes, it might occasionally a missile hits Mykolaiv or occasionally a missile hits Kyiv and occasionally a volley even hits. But these places are not under constant bombardment. They're not being shelled and hit with artillery and hit with enormous military style weaponry. And these places certainly are not being leveled systematically, which is what's going on with the Gaza Strip. So these displaced people can find a place that's still within their country and accessible to them where they can at least survive. That's not really the case in the Gaza Strip. Obviously the entire strip is still under military occupation, but there's nowhere to actually go in the Gaza Strip. The Israelis did declare Rafah a safe zone. Occasionally they bombed it anyway, but they certainly haven't leveled Rafah like they did with the rest of the city, or excuse me, the rest of the strip. And so Gaza European Hospital is not only a hospital, with 220 beds. It's a hospital with 1,500 people admitted to it, despite having 220 beds. It's a hospital with 15,000 people sheltering on the hospital grounds and in the hospital itself. These people are staying in family units. The family, you can imagine, it's an Arab society. The family unit is very strong. So people have stayed in their family units, and literally from the detriment, like, these are mostly people who are displaced from the north. It's not mostly people from Khan Yunis, even though that's the city where the hospital is located. These people came south with whatever means they had. Then they went into other people's houses, took out random stuff like sheets and carpets or whatever they could, moved into Gaza European Hospital with these things and set them up in the hallways. So these hallways that used to be, I don't know, I'd have to estimate, but maybe 20 feet wide are now 4 feet wide because there's a family living on, like, literally on one side of that. And it's densely lined that way. So that's one thing that's extremely unusual. I've never been in a hospital that was also a DP camp. Number two is because of the massive displacement of people, the infrastructure is just totally and completely overwhelmed. I mean, there, I walked the whole hospital grounds. I wasn't organizing the camp, but I think there were 4 toilets for the 15,000 people there. So you can imagine this obviously results in the sewage system flooding every 5 minutes. A third thing, every single healthcare worker in the Gaza Strip, and including in Gaza European Hospital, none of them have been paid since October 7th. They're all working purely on a voluntary basis. This is the last thing I'll say about what you were saying about what makes it different from other places. That instills a fear that is so severe that I cannot really describe it. Every Palestinian doctor I know there was waking up with nightmares, and they're all living in the same room as their family right now. So literally reaching over and grabbing their children to make sure they're still there. Constantly throughout the night, you know, it's palpable. And honestly, I'm an American. I mean, I kind of look Arab, but I'm not. My family's of Indian and Pakistani origin. I don't speak Arabic. I don't have any organic connection to the Middle East. But even I was worried that if I'm arrested by the, or kidnapped, whatever the right word is, by the Israelis, that they might treat me this way too. And that's, it's hard to, you want to pretend it doesn't affect you, but it really affects you. It's very, very hard to pretend it doesn't. And I don't, you know, for me, the risk is like 0.01%. For these guys, it's palpable. It's quantifiable, you know? So those were the major things.
We have a sense of what it looks like from video, right? And that is incomplete, obviously, but in terms of destruction of buildings or, you know, like, there is a lot of stuff that circulates on social media. One of the things that I was struck by your piece was that, that you and Perlmutter wrote was that it was so sensory, right? So can you give a sense to our, you know, give a sense to our listeners here about, like, what, you know, like, what people are not witnessing just from watching videos from Gaza?
Yeah. So I did go to Rafah in a car one day just to see the town. And just to see what it looks like when 2 million people are in a place meant for 200,000. But aside from that, I was in the hospital or just right around the grounds of the hospital the entire time. But, you know, what I'll say about that is that when like I said, the whole place is overwhelmed, right? So, like, we get out of the car and immediately you're just like, holy cow, like that is an aggressive smell. The whole grounds of the hospital, again, it's literally a displaced persons camp. There's 4 toilets for, again, I think it was, I was told it's 15,000 people, who knows? So you can imagine what it smells like. It's hot. It's, you know, it's 75, 80 degrees there with direct sun. There's no breeze at all. And then the, you know, like if Khan Yunis is here, Gaza European Hospital is right here. So this area is under literally continuous and sustained bombardment from the air and the ground, and maybe from the sea, I don't know, but certainly from the air and the ground. And the Israelis are dropping American bombs on these houses and neighborhoods that are meant to, like, penetrate reinforced concrete military bunkers. They're not meant to destroy civilian buildings. So the amount of debris and the just everything, the air is just thick sometimes. Like you would, you had a sense that it was probably like the right bomb went off when the wind was blowing the right way. But every so often you'd be walking through, we slept in a little outlying area of the hospital called the Midan. I think it means square or something, but we lived there, and this was maybe a 5 or 6 minute walk into the hospital. There'd be times when you would walk outside and just go, oh my God, like I can't even see. There's so much debris and dust in the air. And, you know, no one else even notices it. They're just totally, the kids don't, they just cough more. They like, no one even pays attention to it. I'm like, oh God, oh God. They're like, what the hell's wrong with this guy? One of the most visceral things that I noticed was the moment, I would say, of the most intense bombardment that I felt. It was just all of a sudden, I mean, bam, 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 like just like two or three dozen just earth-shaking explosions that I happened to be outside. The ground is literally shaking. These tents are shaking. Things are falling over, and no one notices. Like, the children do not even pay attention to it. There was a mom wheeling her right when all this, like when this really hit hard, there was a mom wheeling her kid in a wheelchair. The kid had all four, like maybe an 8 or 9 year old kid, all four limbs are bandaged up. He's like this, and they're cooing with each other while the whole earth is shaking. And it's surreal. Like it's like I'm like choking on this, and they're just like cooing with each other because they're just used to it. You know, and that seeing that kind of, like, it's hard to explain. I'm not a particularly articulate person, unfortunately. It's hard to explain how weird it is to think about, like, what phase of their lives did I catch them in that this doesn't bother them? You know what I mean? It's dramatic. And then on top, you know, there's other stuff too. I mean, you know, like the operating, everything's filthy, right? I mean, you for the first few days, you try not to shake hands with people, and then you realize it's just totally a lost cause. There's no soap anywhere. I don't know why nobody told us about this I should have taken a whole suitcase full of bar soap, like quite literally. Like, have you ever gone camping? And you go into like the camping bathroom that's like gross and doesn't actually flush, right? Like the latrine. And you find someone left a little bar of soap in there, and it's been soaking up water for days. It's like disgusting. Whenever you found that in Gaza, you were like, oh, sweet. Let me scrape the top of it off and actually wash my hands instead of just caking more hand sanitizer on myself. You know, like we never actually scrubbed for surgery once because there was no soap. There were no scrub brushes. There was nothing. Like, it was crazy. And then on top of that, the traumas we saw were really interesting. You know, most of the patients that we would get would come in mass casualty events. Like, so Khan Yunus, most of the buildings in Khan Yunus were empty, because most of the people in Khan Yunus had fled south to Rafah when Khan Yunus was invaded. And then the people from the north came in and reoccupied some of these buildings, the ones who couldn't get onto the hospital grounds or wherever else. So the people were concentrated in specific buildings, and the Palestinian Red Crescent, the ambulance service, they knew which buildings were occupied and which ones weren't. So they when a building that was occupied was bombed or damaged in some way, that's when they would go out and they would alert us. And when people did come in, you know, and again, you're using like incredibly powerful military hardware to just completely obliterate a house that has 40 or 50 people sheltering in it. The walls, the tile floor, everything is just torn up and just thrown into these people. The level of dust and debris that was actually like just embedded in people's skin was just dramatic. I've never seen anything like it. It was like Superman had taken some dust and just gone like, and then like, you know, it's just like embedded in their skin. There's nothing you can do about it. And then this is a very, very conservative, very modest, you know, modesty is at like the highest premium in this society. And so people are wearing layer after layer after layer of clothing. They will not let you undress them. Because like in the US, the first thing you do when someone's been shot or in an explosion is you rip all their clothes off and look at all of their skin, but they just won't let you do that. In fact, even the hospital staff won't let you do that, even if you wanted to, and their family wasn't there. So you like lift up her hijab or her whatever, her clothing, and dust and debris is just falling. You're literally trying to examine someone. You're getting this blast of dust and debris in the face. You know, the burns, I don't know if you've ever been in a place where someone has been burned, but the smell and the sensory overwhelmingness, I guess, of burn patients, badly burned patients, is really dramatic. In fact, something we have to teach people in the United States when they care for burn patients is don't pay attention to the burns at first, because they might have been, you know, they were probably in a car crash or they jumped out of a building or something. The burns aren't going to kill them right away, but your brain just focuses because it's like, you know, it's so dramatic. The presentation of it is so dramatic. You know, because it was so crowded, it's always just, everything is just jam-packed with people. I don't think I was ever in a room by myself for more than 5 minutes, other than a toilet stall, like literally. Even though I was, you know, we're the American surgeons coming, yay for us, we were still six to a room. You know, six, it was me and me and five other guys living in this room. And then the other half of the we were actually lucky because we had beds that were above the floor. The other six had to live in on mattresses that were literally right up next to each other and on the floor. So the everything's dirty. I showered three times while I was there in a freezing cold shower. Obviously, there's no heated water, or at least not frequently. I was desperately thirsty. I lost about 15 pounds while I was there in just 2 weeks. I was 180 when I left. I was 166 when I came back. When I flew back, I drank so much water that the stewardess at some point asked me if I was okay. I was like, yeah, sorry. I'm just really, I think I'm probably pretty dehydrated. So yeah. So from a sensory standpoint, it's pretty overwhelming when you're walking, or when you first get there and you're part of an NGO, they give you a little vest that has like its logos everywhere. And it's obviously just meant for when they're taking pictures so they can take credit for whatever you did. And the kids in the camp quickly figure out that if you're wearing this vest, you're a foreigner. And if you're a foreigner, you probably have some money. These kids are kind of being directed, I don't know, by older kids or by adults, I'm not sure, but to like go up to any foreign adult that they see. So the first thing they say is, what's your name? Then they say, money, money, money. And this just continues. And it's very endearing the first time it happens. And you try to comfort the child. I'm so sorry. I don't like, cause I could, I'm a pretty wealthy person, but I could take all the money I own there. I'd be gone in 5 minutes. You know, it's not, there's the, there's probably 8,000 children on this hospital grounds. If I give them each a dollar every day, I'll be broke pretty soon, even though I'm, like I said, I'm pretty well off. So the having to basically ignore these kids. So first of all, I stopped wearing the jacket because I kind of look Arab. So I stopped wearing the jacket and that helped a little bit, but like, they still ask. And because I don't speak Arabic to save my life, or, you know, my Arabic is terrible. As soon as I open my mouth, they can tell I'm an American, even if I say salam alaikum or something, you know? So so then it starts, and it's honestly, I don't think I've ever had anything drain my sense of like my own basic human decency than realizing that I had to ignore all of these children and just say, halas, halas. So like, meaning like enough, or leave me alone. When I like every day, actually multiple times a day, because he didn't walk back and forth, because the only place I could actually wash my hands was in our room. But it makes you feel like something you don't want to be, I guess, is the way you.
Yeah. I mean, as you pointed out, I mean, this is one of the many things that makes this war tragic is how young the population is. You articulated a bunch of the ways in which this is a really kind of singular conflict with respect to the other kinds of places you've been where there's also this sort of humanitarian suffering. I guess two questions I had. I mean, one, what you're describing in the hospital is basically like a hospital that is no longer functioning in terms of like what we think a hospital should be, right? And I imagine that makes, the operating conditions and everything else just almost impossible. So I imagine, I mean, beyond just the, the bombs and everything else, I mean, I would guess there are all sorts of other secondary problems that are like medical problems that are arising that if Israel hadn't so relentlessly bombed this population and there was actually a functioning hospital, you know, I imagine there's a lot of secondary issues, right, that just stem from that. Were you did you see the fact that this population was so young reflected in the patients? Like, were most of your patients on the younger side?
Yes. At least half of our patients were children, meaning young children, like elementary school or down, or I guess middle school or down. I don't know. It's kind of hard to tell because, again, the strip has been blockaded for 16 years. So anybody who is 10 years old has never eaten enough, has never, you know, so they've never, everybody's smaller and thinner than they should be. But yeah, no, the demographics of the strip were very clearly reflected in the victims that we saw, or I should say the patients that we saw when we were in the ER. Like I said, most of the cases we would see would come in as mass casualty events, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 people at the same time, something like that. And yeah, no, the majority of people that we treated were children. But there's two like separate populations that they're the same population, but that you can maybe conceptualize them separately. One was the patients that I saw in the trauma bay. That was, again, like I said, overwhelmingly women and children. I think Amy Goodman asked on Democracy Now! The other day, but I think we saw four. I personally saw four or five men who could even be considered military age, and that's stretching it, like including like a 55-year-old in military age, which is not really not normally how you would do it. Maybe saw four or five young men. Again, at least half. The large majority of the rest were women, and then the small smattering of the rest were old men. And again, all basically statistical error when you're talking about military age men, which I thought was kind of shocking. I thought even just by happenstance, there would be, you know, military age men who are not in Hamas or some other group, you know, that just, they were at home too. Right. But I think in general that, sorry, what was the first thing you asked?
One thing just to follow up on that quickly, you know, what is it? I know that you've been to a lot of conflict zones, right? But I think you mentioned in the piece that children, the suffering placed upon children was new to you, both to you and your co-author in the piece. Can you just expand a bit on that?
I don't think of myself as a particularly emotional person. And I'm a trauma surgeon, so I see people suffering all the time. And that actually is not something that I shouldn't say it doesn't bother me. That sounds callous, but it is something I am used to, and it is something that I can deal with. What surprised me was not actually the suffering. I assume that German children suffered during World War II as well. Like children suffering is normal in war. What surprised me was the evidence of violence deliberately directed at children. So we went to one of the outlying ICUs, and on the bed on the right was a 7 or 8 year old kid. I can't remember if it was a boy or a girl, 7 or 8 year old kid who had been shot in the head and was clearly brain dead. Palestinians don't really have a concept of brain death, so they have to wait until the person dies of sepsis, but was brain dead. In the next bed was a 3-year-old who had been shot in the head and was brain dead. And I remember at the first thing I thought was, the nurse giving us, the nurse showing us around didn't speak English that well. So she said, shot. You know, I was like, she probably means shrapnel because, you know, who would shoot a child in the head? But then, you know, I remembered the story that Musa told me. So we actually pulled up both of their CT scans just because I wanted to see, yeah, no, there's a bullet in their head. It's not shrapnel.
I have one last question to let you go, because we said we would keep you an hour here. But, you know, one thing that as a journalist myself, one of the things that's been a little bit, I don't know what the right word is, because it's not concerning in a way, but it is strange, right? Which is that because journalists are not allowed inside of Gaza, that many of the reports that we have seen, or much of the conditions that we see, are through people like yourself, right? People who are medical professionals from the West who went into Gaza and are giving reports. And because you are American, right, and because you've been affiliated with a lot of great institutions of a higher education, and because you are a doctor, which is a respected profession in this country, that your accounts carry a great deal of weight. When I was thinking about it, when I saw you on Democracy Now!, and what I was, you know, when I read the article that you wrote with Dr. Perlmutter, it was, you know, occurred to me that perhaps like what you are also doing is journalistic work in some ways, because of the the fact that journalists cannot go where you went, right? But also because many journalists have been killed in Gaza. Is that a strange responsibility for you? You know, and how do you process that?
Yeah, in more ways than one. So I'll tell you, I guess, how do I process it a few ways? Number one, for me, my ultimate purpose in going to the Gaza Strip was not to operate on a few people, that's because that's what I do. I'm a doctor, but my purpose in going there was to bear witness to what I think is pretty obviously a major crime, and which I, like you said, I do have kind of a unique position to perhaps make some difference in how that crime is conducted and maybe even help to stop it in some small way. And furthermore, because I think I have an obligation to do that because the crime is being carried out with my money and my military support and my economic and diplomatic support. So I don't know. And yes, I mean, I see what you're saying, where you're saying that our accounts have journalistic value. I would not say that I am a journalist in any meaningful sense. I don't have any training in the field.
Right.
I don't know how to interview somebody. As you can see, I barely speak English, but so for me, it was more of an attempt to bear witness than to conduct journalism, if that makes any sense.
Right. But bearing witness as a form of journalism.
I bet it can be. And, you know, the other thing is that, like, just like physicians have been targeted, like you mentioned, journalists have been targeted.
Right.
There is not a Palestinian journalist who will stay in the same place for 5 minutes right now. Mm-hmm. You know, I went to when we went on that trip to Rafah, there was, I think, maybe it was Kuwaiti TV or some random thing. But we were at Kuwait Special. There's a specialty hospital in Rafah called the Kuwaiti Specialty Hospital. And there was a press crew there that wanted to interview two of the other participants in the mission, a cardiac surgeon and an ICU doctor. And as soon as the interview was over, they jumped in their car and not the doctors, I mean the camera crew. They jumped in their car and just sped away, you know, because they know that they're targets.
Right.
So I would say that in terms of what it means to have been one of the few foreign eyes that's allowed to get on the ground, I would just say there's a reason the Israelis have killed so many journalists. It's perfectly obvious. There's a reason they don't allow human rights workers in.
Right.
It's not because the whole world is anti-Semitic. It's complete nonsense. It's because they're carrying out maybe the greatest crime of the 21st century. I think I'm certainly proud if I can provide some meaningful insight into what's going on there for people like you, other Americans, people of conscience, who can do something about what's going on.
Thank you to Dr. Sidwa for coming on the show. As always, if you would like to get in touch with us, our email is timetosaygoodbyepod@gmail.com. And if you would like to reach out to us on Twitter, it is @TTSGpod. Until next week, we will talk to you soon.